Top Nuggets. So that'll be going on this Saturday. And don't forget, at 7 o'clock tonight, Alyssa Ellen will be behind the board for On the River. Now it's time for All Things Considered.
Members of the National Guard were shot just outside the White House today. One suspect is in custody. We'll give you the latest details on what happened and on the circumstances that led up to the shooting. Today is Wednesday, November 26th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang. Pope Leo is embarking on his first official foreign visit to Turkey and Lebanon.
Here in Turkey, Christians are really a very few and fragile minority.
Also, most of us might assume that the first Thanksgiving was between indigenous people and pilgrims at Plymouth Rock in 1621. But decades earlier, there was another feast in present-day West Texas.
This is where some people say the first Thanksgiving, or as I like to call it, the first Thanksgiving, happened.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dale Willman. Two National Guard members from West Virginia are in critical condition this afternoon after being shot several blocks from the White House. They were part of a contingent deployed to Washington, D.C. by President Trump this summer. A suspect is in custody and was also shot. FBI Director Kash Patel.
This will be treated at the federal level as an assault on a federal law enforcement officer. The FBI will lead out on that mission with our interagency partners, to include the Department of Homeland Security, Secret Service, ATF, DEA. And we're thankful for the mayor's assistance in this matter.
D.C. police say they believe the shooter targeted the Guard members. The White House was briefly placed in lockdown after the shooting occurred. President Trump has updated his original 28-point plan to end the war in Ukraine. As NPR's Franco Ordonez reports, Trump says there are now only a few remaining points of disagreements.
President Trump says he's dispatching his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, to Moscow to meet with President Putin, while sending Army Secretary Dan Driscoll to meet with the Ukrainians to work out the final details. It's just the latest iteration of yo-yoing proposal that Trump has presented as he tries to cement his peacemaking legacy. Ivo Dalder, a former U.S. ambassador to NATO, says all Trump wants is a deal.
He doesn't care what the terms of the deal are. He just wants it to end and to be seen as the person who ended it.
But Dalder says the problem is that while the U.S. agreed to plans with both Russia and Ukraine, Russia and Ukraine have not reached an agreement on any plans with each other. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
A judge in Georgia has dismissed the state's election interference case against President Trump and several other people. That move ends the last attempt to prosecute Trump over his efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss. Six Democrats in Congress say they're being investigated by the FBI after they made a video telling members of the military that they can refuse illegal orders. President Trump called the message seditious behavior punishable by death. NPR's Sam Greenglass has more.
The White House later said the president was not suggesting the six Democrats be killed. But the Trump administration has taken steps to potentially punish the group. The Pentagon launched an investigation into Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, and now all six say the FBI has requested interviews. Senator Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan told reporters on Tuesday that Trump is attempting to stifle criticism, including over the president's moves to strike alleged drug boats and dispatch troops in U.S. cities.
This is a scare tactic by him. He is attempting to use the FBI to scare us out of continuing to talk.
The FBI and the Justice Department declined to comment. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
All major indices closed up on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 314 points. The S&P 500 gained 46 points. This is NPR News. Many lightning strikes created by whirling dust devils have been detected by a rover on Mars. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, scientists had long suspected that the red planet might have some form of lightning, but it's been elusive.
Since the 1970s, scientists have thought that swirling dust on Mars might produce some kind of electrical discharge. Like on Earth, clouds of turbulent volcanic ash can create lightning. Now, in the journal Nature, a team says that in windy conditions, a microphone on NASA's Perseverance rover sometimes did more than just hear wind. Dozens of times, it registered a distinctive pattern of electrical interference followed by the acoustic signal of a shockwave. They say this had to have been from electrical arcs just a few centimeters long. They want to learn more about this electrical activity to understand what risks, if any, it might pose to future human or robotic missions. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Israel handed over the bodies of 15 Palestinians today. The exchange came one day after Hamas returned the remains of an Israeli hostage. The exchanges are part of the ceasefire that went into effect last month. The remains of two hostages held by Hamas are still to be returned. Hamas says their recovery has been slowed by the destruction to Gaza during the war with Israel. A court in Peru has sentenced former President Martin Vizcarra to 14 years in prison. Vizcarra had been found guilty of corruption for accepting bribes when he was governor of a Peruvian state. He was sent to prison immediately after the sentencing. He is also barred from holding public office for 9 years. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's 4:06, all things considered. Up next, National Public Radio giving us the latest on shootings of National Guard members in front of the White House this afternoon. I'm Heidi Holton. Our thanks goes out to the Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji with full-service interior painting in residential and commercial locations in northern Minnesota. BorealBrushworksPainting.com. Winter weather advisory still in effect for portions of northeastern Minnesota. Temperatures tonight 17 to 22.
Our news, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. A moment that has rattled the nation's capital today. Two National Guard members were shot near the White House this afternoon. The D.C. police say one suspect is in custody, and President Trump posted on social media that the alleged shooter was severely wounded. For more, we're joined now by NPR's Tom Bowman. Hi, Tom.
Hey, also.
So catch us up here. What do we know at this point?
Well, we know both were from the West Virginia National Guard. They were taken to George Washington University Hospital just a few blocks away. Initially, the West Virginia Governor, Patrick Morrissey, wrote on X that there were conflicting reports of their health status. Now we know they're in critical condition. Now, the two were shot close to the White House, about two blocks away at the Farragut North Metro Station. Police say they have a suspect in custody. No detail on that person. And a video taken by a bystander shows guardsmen tackling a man. And next to him, there's a shattered window from a bus shelter.
Terrifying. And I understand, Tom, that you were at the scene not long after the incident. What did you see there?
Well, police closed off the area. We couldn't get within a block of the metro station, but we did talk with two young women, Emma McDonald and Layla Christopher from Northern Virginia, who were just coming out of the metro moments after it happened. Here's Layla.
We were getting off the metro coming from Vienna, and we were getting off at Farragut Square, and then we, came up to the street, and a National Guards person told us to, run.
So they ran into a bakery a few steps away. Customers in there told them they heard six shots. Many people were afraid. Others, Elsa, were just sitting there drinking their coffee. Emma said she wasn't afraid because there were so many police and guard troops around. She also hopes to be a nurse, so she noticed a special device called a Lucas device that maintains a heart rate, while you're being transported to the hospital. And she looked out and saw this.
We saw an EMT truck pull up, and then they left with an empty truck. 2 minutes later, came back with somebody with a Lucas device, and the National Guard member was covered in blood on his head. He had the Lucas device, which is a machine that keeps the, so you don't have to do it manually. So there was no pulse. That means there was no pulse.
Oh, God. Tom, can you just remind everyone, why have National Guard troops been on the streets in Washington, D.C.?
Well, they've been deployed since August, more than 2,000 troops, including 180 from West Virginia. President Trump ordered the deployment, as you remember, to help reduce crime. Mm-hmm. And they've been patrolling mostly in the tourist areas near the monuments in Georgetown. And also they've been picking up trash, removing graffiti. And just yesterday, the government filed an appeal looking to have a ruling from a federal judge who blocked the deployment. And just after the shooting, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said President Trump has ordered another 500 Guard troops to D.C.
I mean, today has been so horrifying, and I want to talk about just leading up to today. How much have members of the Guard been harassed, would you say, in D.C. specifically?
There's been some harassment, people yelling at them, sometimes throwing things at them. Others have said, you know, we're glad you're here. But, you know, no real violence until what we saw today, really. But, you know, the Guard is controversial on the streets of U.S. cities. Some like them here, others don't. And we're seeing this play out all around the country. In Illinois, I'm told by a Guard officer, the Guard Facebook page is full of words like traitor and Nazis and SS, and they haven't even hit the streets yet. So, again, very controversial and just very troubling.
That is NPR's Tom Bowman. Thank you so much, Tom.
You're welcome.
So many of the biggest movies of the last few years have one thing in common. From Inside Out 2...
I'm anxiety. I'm one of Riley's new emotions. And
to
we are just...
a Minecraft movie.
Chicken Jockey!
To Wicked. All of these films are all rated PG, yes, for parental guidance. And that is surprising, because many of Hollywood's biggest hits have been rated PG-13. So what's behind the current love of PG movies, and why are kids the most influential moviegoers in the industry right now? Well, we're going to direct those questions to Wall Street Journal columnist Ben Cohen, who wrote about this trend in his latest piece. Welcome, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Elsa.
Well, thanks for being with us. Okay, so yeah, why are PG-rated movies so successful right now, you think?
Well, there are actually a bunch of reasons. One is that the success of PG movies is partly about the struggle of PG-13 movies. These days, a movie that comes along and gets adults to theaters without their children feels like something of a miracle. But the people who actually are still going to movies and want to go to movies as soon as that movie is out are children. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. One is that they are obsessed with this idea of participatory fandom.
Aww.
Think about singing along to Wicked or dressing up for Minions or getting all the Minecraft references, right?
Oh, totally.
And all of those viral frenzies have helped movies become something like movements in recent years.
But why is that a kid thing? I like to participate. And I'm almost 50.
So I think the difference is that you and I might wait a month for a movie to become available on demand at home if it means you can watch that movie from the comfort of your couch.
Oh,
and you don't
laziness
have to,
takes
exactly.
over.
Exactly. Yes. Well, okay. And also like cost effectiveness. Like you don't have to pay for tickets and popcorn and a babysitter if you're just going to pay the $29.95 to rent it at home. So you might wait, but kids won't, because for them, the whole point of seeing a movie is getting in on all the memes around that movie, which means seeing it as quickly as they possibly can.
Okay, but what is the whole PG versus PG-13 thing? Because you mentioned in your piece that so many of like the highest grossing films were rated PG-13, not PG. I'm talking about movies like Titanic, the Avengers movies, Avatar. So why the shift away from that? Why aren't PG-13 titles doing as well right now?
I think you really have to go back to IP. If you think about the hits from the past few years, they're all based on intellectual property that kids have a deep connection with already.
Yeah.
So there are the sequels. There's Inside Out 2 and Moana 2 and all of the Minions movies.
Mm-hmm.
There's Wicked, which is based on not just a Broadway musical, but, you know, one of the most famous movies of all time.
Right. Wizard of Oz.
There are all of the video games, Super Mario Brothers and Minecraft, which really surprised Hollywood when they turned into massive hits at the box office.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think about one of the PG movies this year that actually didn't really work, and that was Disney's Snow White. And that is an iconic Disney movie, but kids today don't really have much of a connection to Snow White.
Exactly.
They care more about SpongeBob, which, as it happens, is coming to theaters next month and is probably going to be another smash PG movie.
Well, you know, I'm just remembering back when I was a kid when the PG-13 rating first came out. This was back in 1984, right? In the middle of the 80s. And by then, there were already all these iconic Hollywood blockbusters like Jaws and Star Wars, which were rated PG at the time. But maybe Jaws and Star Wars would be rated PG-13 these days, or even R, right? Had there been a PG-13 rating back then for those movies, do you think that would have affected the success of Jaws or Star Wars?
Possibly, right? I mean, it's also hard to know because movie theater-going culture was so different in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, even part of the 2010s. than it is today. And, you know, one of the things that really surprised me about the success of PG movies is that the people going to the theaters to see these movies are exactly the people who have grown up with the ability to watch any movie on any device they want, anytime they want, right? And, you know, kids have always gone to the movie theater to hang out and to escape their parents also. But in 2020 and 2021, this century of long-established habits was suddenly disrupted. And there was real fear in the industry that once audiences were watching these movies at home, they would not want to come back to theaters. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the opposite has happened. Yeah. And so there was a recent National Research Group survey that found that Gen Alpha prefers movie theaters more than Gen Z or Millennials or Gen X. So
interesting.
These people who, like everyone thought, maybe won't come back to the theaters, they want to come back to the theaters more than anyone.
Ben Cohen with the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elsa.
When the northern lights dramatically lit up skies across the country earlier this month, poet Silas House was among those who were dazzled from below.
You know, we could see them just about a week ago.
House is a former state poet laureate in Kentucky. His new volume of poetry touches on loss, natural disaster, and the northern lights. NPR's Netta Ulaby has more.
Silas House always thought you had to go to Iceland or Alaska to see the northern lights, but he saw them in Appalachia.
Living in the South, you never think you're going to see the northern lights from your own home. And here lately, we have been seeing the northern lights.
The first time, a few years ago, they inspired this love poem.
Northern lights, I longed for you before I knew you. That's what I always think when something like this happens. I never dreamt I would see them, especially from my own back porch, right here in Kentucky. But there they are, the richest purple, glowing green, the blush of them, an undulating mystery, as abstract as the enigma that brings two people into the same orbit. Here we are, watching them together, and we always will be, even when we are nothing more than sky.
And who is this love poem dedicated to?
Oh, this is for my husband. We've been together almost 20 years.
The two of them were thrilled, he says, by the communal joy of seeing pictures of the northern lights on the news and social media. A much-needed jolt, says Silas House, of wonder.
There are all kinds of different magics in our everyday lives. And of course, I mean, as corny as it sounds, love is the biggest one of all.
House's new collection of poetry is called All These Ghosts. It came out in September. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Up next, it's our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer. I'm Heidi Holton. Weather around our region still is a winter weather advisory in portions of northeastern Minnesota. We'll see blustery winds across the region out of the northwest from 10 to 25. Mostly cloudy for Thanksgiving tomorrow with highs in the low to mid-20s. Thanks to Bridget's Pub for their support in downtown Bemidji with Irish and American food. Monday night trivia, 6:30. Open mic night, Thursdays at 6:30. More on Facebook.
On today's date, November 26th in 1986, I get a report of common loons congregating on Sugar Lake south of Grand Rapids. There are more than 25 loons in the flock, and 20 of them will dive at a time, feeding, grabbing up shiners and eating them, while the others sit quietly on the surface and keep an eye out for any predators that might come by. These are more than likely juvenile loons that have no parents around and are simply waiting for the opportunity to head south. And when that notion strikes them, they will, in fact, get up and start south. it's not as simple as it would be for the parents. The parents oftentimes head south just over to Lake Michigan, down to Tennessee, and out into the ocean, and it's a pretty quick process. But these guys are novices, and sometimes their wanderings will take them all across the eastern half of the United States as they search out a way to find the ocean.
And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang. The first American pope is making his first overseas trip this week to Turkey and Lebanon. He will mark the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea in a town not far from present-day Istanbul. Duri Buskerin went out to the ruins of the church where early Christian leaders shaped the foundations of their faith.
If you're a churchgoer, you might be familiar with this prayer.
I believe in one God, the Father Almighty.
The Nicene Creed. A version of this prayer is spoken by the majority of the world's 2.3 billion Christians. It's essentially an outline of early Christian beliefs, first adopted by the church in the year 325. It's something that Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox churches still share, sometimes chanted, sometimes spoken, or even sung. But this universal prayer was first hammered out 1,700 years ago by a council of bishops who gathered in a city then known as Nicaea. Today, that town is in western Turkey, and it's called İznik. It's the kind of place where olive groves and modern homes intermingle with Roman and Ottoman ruins. For a long time, no one could find the church where the first ecumenical council was held. But 11 years ago, public workers taking aerial photographs of the area shared them with Turkish archaeologist Mustafa Şahin. Under the waters of Lake İznik, just off the shore, Şahin quickly recognized the foundations of an ancient church. It was under about 8 feet of water, he tells me. But locals knew about the ruin. Sometimes when the water was low, swimmers would rest on the rocks. Today, the shoreline has receded, and the entire outline of a church foundation is on dry land. As we walk through, Şahin points out the semicircle of the apse, dozens of graves lining the sides, and what he believes is a large baptismal pool. Şahin strongly believes that this was the church where the first Council of Nicaea was held. He thinks an earthquake in the 11th century may have changed the shoreline enough to submerge the structure. As evidence, he points out that the location and orientation of the church on the shore of the lake outside the city walls matches the background of a 16th century painting of the council in the Sistine Chapel.
So this is kind of a foundational moment that creates this kind of basis for Christianity.
Raul Zagara is an expert in Catholic theological studies at the Harvard Divinity School. He says this is the moment when early Christian bishops got together and agreed on a set of beliefs that they would all share.
It's this basic idea that Jesus Christ was not just a man or somebody created by, you know, the divine, but he was divine himself.
On Friday, Pope Leo is scheduled to visit the ruin of the church and pray alongside leaders of the Orthodox faith. Zagara says it's a sign he plans to prioritize unity and outreach with other denominations during his papacy.
And I think it's an invitation also to think about the theological and moral convictions that bring different Christian denominations and traditions together, despite the differences that, of course, still exist.
Turkey's tourism ministry has erected a raised walkway next to the ruins in anticipation of the trip. And Turkish tourists like Önder Gönültaş are already stopping by. This was a holy place for Christians, and we're looking out for their relics, he says. His friend, Ayla Derya, agreed. Our country is a cradle for many civilizations, and it's such a beautiful thing, she says. This needs to be protected, and we invite everyone to see it. Early Christianity is steeped in references to places that are now in modern-day Turkey. Ancient Antioch, where the term Christian was first used. Even Myra, the home of a saint that inspired the Santa Claus of popular culture. But today, fewer than 400,000 Christians are believed to live in Turkey. At the Saint Esprit Cathedral in Istanbul, a West African choir sings for the Sunday service.
The Catholic community living in Turkey probably is not more than 60,000 people.
Bishop Massimiliano Palinuro says his congregation is mostly foreign workers, refugees, and the descendants of Europeans who settled in the Ottoman Empire.
Here in Turkey, Christians are really a very few and fragile minority. Because of this, since we live in a Muslim country, we feel more than in other places the necessity to live together, to support each other, to pray together.
When he holds Mass, he says he can look out and see faces from 20 countries. And this, he says, is what it means to be Catholic.
The Church is Catholic because it's universal. And so nobody may feel stranger and foreign when you are in the Church, because we are Catholic.
And this experience of unity is something he hopes Pope Leo will be able to foster when he visits. For NPR News, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Holidays bring to mind those we have lost in the previous year, and colleagues and fans alike will always think of Susan Stamberg at Thanksgiving. Not only was she one of NPR's founding mothers, a phrase that she coined, but this time of year, many of us will remember Susan for one special thing.
Many, many Thanksgivings ago, my fiancé took me home to Allentown, Pennsylvania, to be inspected by his family. My mother-in-law-to-be served a relish that was so delicious, I married her son.
That's right, that pink pile of mush, cranberry relish, which has become practically synonymous with Mama Stamberg. Every year, she would bring that delicacy to listeners.
2 cups whole raw cranberries washed, absolutely. 1 small
but
onion.
But then here come the funny things. There's
sugar,
a small
sour cream
onion.
Don't skimp on the sour cream.
3/4 cup
wait
sour
cream. Horseradish.
Horseradish.
And it's bright pink.
It looks like a Jell-O product that my grandmother used to make.
Susan, when are you inviting me over for Thanksgiving?
Are you familiar with this recipe?
I am not, but I know it from having you tell me about it.
I'm kind of scared to taste it.
Okay, Pepto-Bismol.
Pepto-Bismol. Okay, this year I think I have to say it's the color of Barbie pink.
The color is a little weird.
That's tasty.
You like it?
I do like it.
I'm Coolio with the flow, the ghetto gourmet.
My first rapper.
And I got a fetish for that cranberry relish.
It's delicious.
Is there any way you can turn this recipe into rap?
You won, Susan Stamberg. I will make your cranberry stuff.
You take some cranberry, a little bit of horseradish, and some onions. Now I got a relish, fellas. Mama Stamberg, that's what y'all heard. It's Coolio, not Stamberg. With some cranberries, a little bit of onion, y'all, and some horseradish. Now I got a fetish for that relish, and it's pink out. Better pour your drink out.
Susan Stamberg, you could make any story sing. This is NPR News.
It's 4:29. Coming up, National Native News here on People Powered KAXE. We're learning about the Navajo Nation Council that is considering a motion to remove the tribe's president. Stay tuned for that story. Then it is North Star Stories. And later in an hour, you'll hear the local news from the Up North Report. You can find local news at our website, kexe.org. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants, funding available to individuals and organizations that create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. Looking at the weather, we are seeing mostly cloudy skies tonight, still blustery winds out of the northwest, 10 to 25, low 17 to 22. Could see some additional snow on the Iron Range, about an inch. And tomorrow, Thanksgiving, mostly cloudy, highs in the low to mid 20s.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation Council is considering a motion to remove the tribe's president, Boo Nigrant, and Vice President Rochelle Montoya after a special prosecutor accused Nigrant of misusing government funds. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the council could have taken action as early as Thursday until a judge in Window Rock, Arizona, stepped in.
Council Speaker Crystalline Curley sponsored the bill to oust the pair. Nigrant has accused Curley of seeking his removal so she can take his place.
All I can say, this is not a political move on my part. This is a necessary step to protect our nation's financial stability.
Two-thirds of the 24-member council must approve, and it's unclear whether Curley has the votes. On Friday, she released 465 pages detailing allegations and hoped for a swift vote while acknowledging that delegates needed time to examine the evidence.
Given the complexity of the issue, the number of alleged violations, and the volume of documents involved, pretty sure that a vote before Thanksgiving is very unlikely. A more realistic timeline would be after the holiday.
That timeline changed Tuesday when a judge granted a motion from Nigrant's attorneys to block the bill pending a hearing next month. As for Vice President Montoya, who was elected independently from Nigrant, she denies involvement with any of his alleged violations and says he stripped her duties, resources, and budget. One invoice documented a $3,000 loan for travel expenses Nigrant said he needed because of an argument with his wife, Apache County Attorney Jasmine Blackwater Nigrant. He also spent $3,000 renovating his Apache County home and borrowed nearly $1,200 renting tables and chairs for his daughter's birthday party. Another $6,000 went directly to his then chief of staff, Patrick Sandoval, to cover car repairs. Sandoval also got a loan to gift Nigrant a $1,500 birthday present. It's unclear, according to the receipts, whether anything has been paid back. When asked, Nigrant's staff reiterated he would not comment on any specifics. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
This year, five Native Americans were among 29 people named Bush Fellows. The Bush Fellowship provides up to $150,000 over 2 years for fellows to build on their leadership skills. In the third of five profiles, Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire highlights an Oglala Lakota advocate for the arts and boosting financial support for creative Natives.
Lori Puyer has been active in the arts for decades, but beyond making art, she also wanted to find ways to make it sustainable within tribal communities. When Puyer became active with the First Peoples Fund in 1999, she coordinated research into the arts in Native communities, particularly the Pine Ridge Reservation.
And through that research, we found that 71% of the households were engaged in some sort of tradition-based, home-based business, but 52% of that household was tradition forms of art. So that's how the Rolling Res Arts bus was born, because we were seeing the needs for artists, and then being in a community the size of Pine Ridge, it was hard for artists to get to our training workshops, and we'd partner with Lakota Funds, which is a loan fund. And it was really our artist idea.
The Rolling Res Arts bus has traveled 8,000 miles across the Pine Ridge and Cheyenne River reservations and even visited the Sacred Stone Camp at Standing Rock. It also doubles as a mobile bank and teaches Native artists about running a business and accessing credit and capital. Puyer says she'll use her Bush Fellowship to explore socially responsible ways to invest in Native artists that align with cultural values. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND. The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IACB, who support this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang. Let's take a moment to recap the last week of U.S. attempts to strike peace between Russia and Ukraine. The Trump administration developed a 28-point peace plan, credited largely to U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. After it leaked, it was so widely seen as friendly to Russia that Secretary of State Marco Rubio went on social media to reject claims that Russia wrote the peace plan. Since then, U.S. officials have been making key revisions to the plan with Ukrainian and other European officials. All this has former U.S. diplomats wondering, how exactly are these talks being conducted? And so we thought we would talk to one of those former diplomats. Kurt Volker was the U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine under the first Trump administration. He joins us now. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So what stands out to you about the way the Trump administration has approached negotiations?
I'd say there's a bit of chaos in this and a little bit of rivalry within the administration, so it seems. I think you have to take it all the way back to the Alaska summit, which was prepared by Steve Witkoff. And an absolute failure. The idea was to have Putin come, welcome him, throw out the red carpet, but get a ceasefire. Well, all of that had to be scrapped because Putin had no intention of agreeing to a ceasefire. After that, of course, there were phone calls. Trump assigns Rubio, talked to Foreign Minister Lavrov, and Rubio does, is told point blank by Lavrov, same terms, we want everything and more. So Rubio reports that to Trump, and the meeting in Budapest is canceled. Immediately after that, the Russians send Kirill Dmitriev to Florida to meet with Steve Witkoff because they didn't like what they heard from Rubio. They wanted to talk to somebody else. And so Witkoff talks with them. They spend 3 days. They come up with this plan. But it is, of course, 100% the Russian demands.
I want to touch on several things that you're bringing up here. First, what about the involvement of so many different officials? Like I see U.S. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll is heading to Kyiv later this week. And then Steve Witkoff, the special envoy, plans to travel to Moscow next week. What do you make of their involvement in all these high-level talks?
Normally, if you involve a lot of your different senior officials, that can be a good thing. Unfortunately, in this case, it doesn't seem to be well coordinated. You have the Witkoff plan, which was horrendous, and I think it was so bad that Donald Trump dispatches Rubio to go and clean it up, which he did. And all the reports now are that the U.S. and Ukraine and European allies are all on the same page on a reasonable plan, which is good. But then we're sending Witkoff back to Moscow.
Right.
So are we still talking about the same plan, or is it the first one? Is it the new one? It's really very unclear. And you got to feel for Dan Driscoll because he is a former military guy, Secretary of the Army.
He is not a diplomat.
He's not a diplomat, and he's not a political leader in the same way that Rubio or the president would be. He's following orders.
Can we talk about Rubio, too? Because he is supposed to be the top U.S. diplomat. He's Secretary of State. What role do you see the State Department playing in all of this?
To be honest, I think we have to really talk about the Trump administration very differently than other administrations. Mm-hmm. There isn't really an administration. There is President Trump, who is the sole decider, and he's the leader. He makes the calls. But President Trump is very flexible and will go left one day and right the next day and left again the next day in order to try to navigate what he thinks will be a successful negotiation. So everybody else, in a way, is playing catch-up. That means that the role of the State Department is curtailed. The role of the Secretary of State is curtailed,
right,
compared to what we've seen in previous administrations.
But could you argue, despite the visible chaos, could you argue that there is some merit to President Trump's approach? I say this because he often points to, like, the Israel-Hamas deal as a success for his administration. And he claims success in resolving a number of other wars this year. What do you make of his success?
Well, absolutely, yes. I think President Trump deserves a lot of credit. We went through the entire Biden administration with the phrase, as long as it takes. But we couldn't define what it is. You know, is it strategic victory for Ukraine or a ceasefire or whatever? It's just as long as it takes. That was a open-ended commitment of aid and taxpayer funds to Ukraine. President Trump has flipped that on its head. He has said the goal is to end the war. He wants peace. That is now what everybody is talking about. No one is talking about as long as it takes. Everyone's talking about ending the war.
Ambassador Kurt Volker is a former U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine and a distinguished fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Most Americans think that the first Thanksgiving meal was between indigenous people and pilgrims at Plymouth Rock in 1621. But decades earlier, there was another feast near the banks of the Rio Grande in present-day West Texas. Angela Kucherga with member station KTEP reports on why many historians in the region call that event the true first Thanksgiving.
The centuries-old San Elisario Chapel is gleaming white under a bright blue sky. It's one of three churches on the El Paso Historic Mission Trail, enduring symbols of the Spanish colonial past. San Elisario's chapel is still an active parish.
There's a lot of history in this town.
On a recent Sunday, Corina Chavira, her husband and seven-year-old daughter were among the crowd leaving Mass. Though proud of their historic hometown, many don't know this was the site of what some historians say was the first Thanksgiving gathering in 1598.
Way before the landing at Plymouth Rock.
Historian and author David Romo says Spanish explorer Juan de Oñate and his expedition celebrated their arrival after a grueling trek north that ended near the banks of the Rio Grande.
And so after they crossed, they went back to their camp in San Elisario and invited a lot of these native people. And the native people, as always, were very hospitable, and they brought corn and fish, and they had this meal.
According to Spanish historical records, Oñate and his party gave thanks for their survival and safe passage and put on a play about Christian missionaries.
This is where some people say the first Thanksgiving, or as I like to call it, the first Thanksgiving, happen.
Oñate claimed the land for the Spanish crown and colonized the American Southwest. Yale historian Ned Blackhawk is the author of The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History.
It's deeply ironic and historically inaccurate to frame the first European colonization efforts in either the Rio Grande and or in Plymouth Colony as welcoming and celebratory moments.
Blackhawk says the idea of the traditional American gathering at Plymouth Rock has been mythologized.
The understanding of Thanksgiving as we know it nationally only developed in the late 19th century when the United States was beginning to establish a strong sense of its national identity, distinctive from Europe.
There is another place that claims it was the site of the first Thanksgiving, St. Augustine, Florida, with the arrival of Spanish explorers in 1565. Whatever the origin story, the modern holiday is an opportunity for families to gather together, says Corina Chavira.
Ooh, it's like, what, 20 of us?
Among the blessings they're grateful for?
Being healthy, just being present with our family.
A Thanksgiving tradition many Americans celebrate. For NPR News, I'm Angela Kucherga in San Elisario, Texas.
This is NPR News.
It's 4:43. You're listening to All Things Considered. Here on KAXE, I'm Heidi Holton. Up next, we've got North Star stories, news from where we live, including a story coming out of Bemidji and Lakeland Public Television. We would like to thank ICTV for their support. They connect, inform, and empower the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Weather around our region, there is still a winter weather advisory for portions of northeastern Minnesota with light and blowing snow. Expect northwest blustery winds 10 to 25 and low 17 to 22 tomorrow with highs in the low to mid 20. Check KAXC.org to find a list of free Thanksgiving meals around our region, including at the Brainerd American Legion Post 255 from 11 to 1 o'clock and at MJ's Lodge and Resort in Pengilly from 1 to 4 with a free will donation for the Nashwauk Food Shelf.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, an independent review of how officials handled attacks on Minnesota lawmakers. Then, how Minneapolis residents are getting easier access to health care. And federal budget cuts force a public TV station in northern Minnesota to cancel a marquee local program. I'm Chantel Sings. State and local agencies investigating the June 14th attacks on Minnesota lawmakers have asked the International Association of Chiefs of Police to conduct an independent after-action review. The report will examine the 43-hour manhunt that ended with the arrest of Vance Bolter, who is charged with killing former House Speaker Melissa Hortman, her husband, and shooting Senator John Hoffman and his wife. The review will evaluate how agencies mobilized, coordinated, and communicated during the multi-agency response. It's expected to take about 6 months, and the findings will be made public. Next, a mobile medical unit has hit the streets of Minneapolis, partnering with local organizations to combat the opioid crisis and provide free healthcare services for all. Reporter Yancey Jameson has a story.
A mobile medical unit is on the move in Minneapolis. With the goal of expanding access to medications and treatment, the mobile medical unit reduces opioid overdoses and promotes long-term recovery for those who need it most. MJ is a nurse on board.
Mobile unit, we got a couple of spaces up here. This is our little mini medical room. Medical exam table, our doctor's chair, just like it, and then, yeah, all of our supplies.
With an emphasis on addiction treatment, the mobile medical unit will also offer basic health screenings, medication consultations, and dental care.
So blood sugar, blood pressure, if they have any type of medical concern. A lot of this nursing, it's nursing triage. It's like, where can we get you seen to address the comprehensive needs that you have?
Other programs like the University of Minnesota's Mobile Health Initiative serve Greater Minnesota and are run by medical student and staff volunteers. The new mobile medical unit serves Minneapolis, operating 4 days a week.
So we're in the same places every week for at least a couple of weeks so we can tell people, hey, we'll be back next week at this time.
As the seasons change, unit staff are preparing to address the health concerns that come with cold weather.
So as far as right now, what the needs are we're seeing, it's starting to get colder. A lot of skin concerns, a lot of wound care. So we've really focused on getting our supplies ready to accommodate for that.
Funded with money from the National Opiate Response Settlement, the mobile medical unit requires no payment or insurance for those accessing services and is staffed by a full-time clinical team, including Tony, a peer recovery specialist.
When we're out on the streets, you know, we see people, we're trying to meet them where they are. And so we're seeing people that are, you know, they have the blanket draped over their shoulder and they're in use.
The mobile medical unit partners with local organizations, parking outside businesses in areas with high health disparities, like Little Earth and North Minneapolis.
We're trying to get that medication to people when they're ready for it, we're here for them, and that's kind of the biggest thing. So it's any little thing you can do, if it's addressing a wound with a smile, it's kind of what we're trying to do.
In addition to physical wellness, the team tends to people's mental health as well. Leading with humanity and kindness.
Being able to see them as a person and not as anything else is something that we all strive to do, I think. And so showing kindness to people when other people wouldn't, you know.
Request the mobile medical unit and see the location schedule at minneapolismn.gov. This is Yancey for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Lakeland Public Broadcasting Service, also known as Lakeland PBS, is canceling its long-running public affairs show, Lakeland Currents. Like 10 out of 17 Amper's community radio stations in Minnesota, Lakeland Public TV in Bemidji lost all federal funding. Lakeland Currents aired for 18 seasons, featuring conversations with local leaders and experts on a range of issues. The station says it's facing a $1 million budget shortfall. Lakeland PBS serves about 400,000 viewers in northern and central Minnesota.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang. Even if you do live in Washington, D.C., the Wilbur J. Cohen Federal Building might not sound all that familiar to you. But for art historians and preservationists, the Cohen Building is sacred. It's been referred to as the Sistine Chapel of New Deal art. Well, that site is now under threat because the Trump administration has listed the building for sale, raising fears that a future developer could demolish the site. Here to tell us about what makes the Wilbur J. Cohen Federal Building so amazing is Mary Okin. She's assistant director at Living New Deal, an organization devoted to documenting New Deal art and public works. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Mary, can you just first help us understand what exactly is considered New Deal art?
So New Deal art is art that was produced under a series of programs, agencies, and projects developed under the New Deal that Franklin Delano Roosevelt established to help Americans recover from the Great Depression and the ravages of the Great Depression. The two most prominent being the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, and its Federal Project One, which hired visual artists to paint murals, make crafts, create sculpture, etc. And then the Treasury Department's Section of Fine Arts, which is what the Cohen Building falls within. And that was the most prestigious of these agencies and programs in that it held competitive bids for commissions. And so the best artists, but also up-and-comers, would apply to decorate new federal buildings, such as post offices and major agency headquarters.
And I understand that during this time, the U.S. government was like the single largest patron of contemporary art in the world, right?
That's right. Europe had devolved into World War, as we know, and the United States became both a refuge for artists, some of whom were escaping from Europe, but also a space for supporting the arts nationally. And that was a really a watershed moment for American culture because there had never been such support by the government for both established and young artists.
It sounds incredible this time in terms of how productive the art community became because of this funding. So what makes the Cohen Building exactly the Sistine Chapel of New Deal art, you think?
So I think the artists who were selected created particularly powerful work in this space. Paintings that were large in scale, particularly Ben Shahn's work in the hallways of the building on the first floor, but also because of the subject matter that was being depicted. So Ben Shahn's series of murals depicts the promise of Social Security. In one hall, you have images of people who really were suffering prior to the Social Security Act and the ravages of the Great Depression that affected children and the elderly and the sick. And on the other side, you have paintings that show what is possible when you have Social Security and major images in terms of scale, but also in terms of pulling on the heartstrings, which Ben Shahn as an artist was particularly great at doing. And then in the lobby, when you enter, you have two murals by Seymour Fogel, who's another artist of this era. He created one image called The Security of the Family and another called The Wealth of Nation. And it's an image showing workers, showing industry, showing innovation, and the promise of the 20th century, which we would see realized in the United States becoming, you know, a global superpower economically, socially, and so on.
I mean, I can't imagine these kinds of works being potentially demolished one day, but the U.S. General Services Administration placed this building on its list of assets identified for accelerated disposition. It's part of a standard process for right-sizing federal real estate and saving taxpayer money. That's according to their website. These are their words. When did you first hear that the government was considering selling this building?
So I believe a list was published of this accelerated disposals and in February, and we immediately understood that this building potentially faced threats. It's important to point out the accelerated disposals process is something that's new at the GSA that has not been the way that things have been done previously. And it's what has caused so much, you know, concern among art historians and the preservationist community, because how it will be handled is a real worry.
I imagine so, because let's be very clear, these pieces of art that you have described, these are huge murals. They're painted directly onto the walls of the building. So we're not talking about painted canvases that can just be removed and preserved safely, right?
That's right. It is possible to remove frescoes from the spaces in which they were painted, but it's extraordinarily expensive. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the Ben Shahn murals, but also Philip Guston and Seymour Fogel and others, you risk the potential for damage. And in the case of Shahn specifically, he painted in fresco secco, which makes them particularly delicate. That means painting on dry plaster as opposed to painting on wet plaster that dries into the wall. There have been past efforts to conserve and strengthen those particular artworks because Shahn considered them to be, you know, among his most important works of art.
Well, as you mentioned, this building was originally built to house the Social Security Administration, and you wrote in an editorial in The Hill, quote, that this building stands as a testament to an era when the federal government recognized that democracy thrives not only on sound policy, but also on shared beauty and public purpose. So do you think, Mary, there is a significance or a symbolism to this building that extends beyond just the art contained on its walls?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This building, its art, and the artists who were making work for this building specifically were thinking about the people who would occupy this space, which was meant to be the headquarters of the Social Security Administration. That never came to be realized. But the idea was that people would enter this space and think about the communities that they served. The idea that Social Security would protect people in the way that they had not been protected prior to the Great Depression was a huge achievement. We were among the only countries that didn't have some kind of social welfare for ordinary citizens prior to the Great Depression, and our country really suffered as a result. And so creating art that was meant to capture both the pain and now the possibility and the hope and the prosperity of Americans as a result of the government caring for the people, providing jobs for people, and providing safety nets for people.
Yeah.
I think that's really key.
Mary Okun is Assistant Director at Living New Deal. Thank you so much for speaking with us about this beautiful building.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, now playing in select theaters, everywhere December 5th. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Another hour ahead of All Things Considered, followed by the news from Canada as it happens, and then volunteer Alyssa Allen brings us On the River Tonight, beginning at 7 o'clock. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. NorthHomes.org. This is 91.7 KEXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. People-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Weather tonight, we do have a winter weather advisory still in effect for portions of northeastern Minnesota. Could see